This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Spalding Gray virtually invented the form of theater known as the autobiographical monologue. Although his performances consist of just Gray talking alone on stage, they're often as perceptive and funny as theater gets. His latest monologue is called Monster in a Box. The monster of the title was his novel in progress, a 1900-page manuscript. The monologue was about all the interruptions that happened to him while he was trying to complete the novel. Well, talk about timing. That novel has just been published, coinciding with a new film adaptation of the monologue and a paperback transcription. The novel is no longer a 1900-page monster. It's a trim 228-page semi-autobiographical coming-of-age story. The other 1,700 or so pages will be edited down to a sequel. The new novel begins in Rhode Island, where a young man's overly possessive Christian Scientist mother goes mad and kills herself. The young man, an aspiring actor, leaves home with the mission of learning how to be hip and hang out. But he's really too obsessive and neurotic to be very good at hanging out. In fact, he's so anxious, it's almost impossible for him to have a good time. The novel is called Impossible Vacation, and this reading will give you some idea of why a satisfying vacation is impossible for him. The reading begins after he quits his experimental theater group.
After my disillusionment with art, I turned to fantasies of liberation. The idea now was that I would give up on art and just lead a regular life and become liberated by learning how to live in the moment. The word was clearly out that being here now was all there was, and you better live now or fall prey later to hellish regrets like Mom's what ifs. It could drive you mad to wake up to the fact that your whole life has been about chasing some false goal. I wanted to learn how to just be. I wanted now to take a regular job and work toward accomplishing some personal salvation in my life. I wanted to learn how to hang out in the blissful present. After all, if I was eventually going to Bali someday, if I was ever to try to take a perfect vacation, I knew I had to have a life from which to take it. After all, a vacation doesn't exist without a life that you're vacationing from. So I had to have a regular job, but also I wanted to let go of my past and let go of Mom. I thought that the right way to do this was through Zen meditation, a relatively popular but rigorous route to the blissful present.
Spalding, I have to tell you, when I was reading your novel, I wanted you there sitting, I wanted you to be sitting next to me reading the book to me.
Right.
I wanted to be hearing your voice the whole time. Some of the issues that you talk about in your new book, you know, like the problems of really like letting go and taking pleasure and these kinds of things are things that you've talked about in some of your monologues. What are some of the things you wanted to do in the novel that you hadn't done before?
Well, I wanted to go, what I would say is a little deeper, where that I'm working privately and not, say, trying to entertain the audience or being drawn in by the audience to pander. And I also wanted to try, if I could get a little closer, to a literary form rather than a spoken, because I find that in the literary form, in the spoken form, I'm bringing my presence, right? My eyebrows, my tone of voice, my timing. Mm-hmm. So all of the irony or all of the complexity is there in my presence as well as what I'm saying. But when the monologue is transcribed, in my opinion, it doesn't have the same depth. It's a little flatter because it's missing my presence.
The third dimension.
What I was hoping to do in writing the book was absent myself.
Mm-hmm.
Physically, actually, and to try to live through the written word. And it was a scary business because I struggled so much with a sense of disappearing when I was writing and would have to go for long walks to get back into my body afterwards. I don't know quite how writers stay in their bodies.
It's really amazing now that you have, you know, you have the monologue about the distractions you faced while writing the novel. You have the novel out and you've got a film of the monologue about the book.
Right.
It's like every possible
version. And three audio
tapes
are coming out as well of the monologues.
Oh,
with
great.
Wyndham Hill.
Great.
So it's a real hall of mirrors.
Exactly.
And I'm lost in it right now. I'm really trying to sort out who I am, and all of this material is now out of me and floating out there. So it's another, it's an image of me, but it's not the person that I am right now.
Well, sure, you've got the fictionalized version of you, but I'm sure that even your autobiographical monologues are somewhat fictionalized, too.
Well, I'd say that more hyperbole than and a rearrangement of time, much closer to... I've always been rather embarrassed to fictionalize. And when I started doing in the book, I could see that for the reader it worked, that they didn't know. But for me, I know, because it's glaring, you know, it's glaring. And I for some reason, need to often, you know, define myself by seeing myself, by saying, this really happened to me, so that I actually know who I am. It's a funny kind of thing, by creating my history, by creating it publicly, and then saying, oh, this is who I am, and having that public identity.
Spalding Gray is my guest. So it sounds like this kind of hall of mirrors that you're in is causing, in its own way, an odd identity crisis.
Yes, I'm not sure how to name it exactly, except I feel that I've mined myself in a way that I've gotten a whole lot of material out, and now there's a certain emptiness there that is supposed to be the place from which you begin to create again. But it's always the most frightening place for me, because there's no beginning in sight. Although I have a new monologue in the works that's being published in the New York Times Sunday Magazine on May 17th, and that was a very odd experience. The New York Times said, we want to publish an excerpt from your new monologue. I said, well, I'm not doing it until March in Berkeley. They said, well, that's not soon enough for us, and we'd like to get it in the May issue. So would you sit down and tell it to an editor? And I at first said no, and then I decided I would give it a try, and I did. I sat down in a room with one person and spoke this for the first time, called Gray's Anatomy. And so in a way, since it's being published in the New York Times, it's almost already ahead of me, you know, because it's published before I've mastered it. So it's an odd thing going on now where my work is getting ahead of where I'm at with it. And I have to kind of pull in the reins and get real careful again and real minimal.
So what's the monologue about?
The monologue is about an eye operation I had 2 years ago, and how that triggered a lot of awareness about my own mortality. Also, it is about dealing with doctors and how scary that is, and also alternative healings. The section that's printed in the New York Times is about having my eye diagnosed and the doctor telling me that I could try alternative healings before the operation, and then I happened to go to a sweat lodge, an Indian sweat lodge, where they try to heal my eye by sweating me to death. But so it's a juxtaposition there between new age therapies and traditional medicine.
How is your eye?
The eye is, I had the operation, it's kind of stabilized, left eye now, and kind of blurry. And the point is that it will never be back to what it was. And this is the first thing in my life where that ever happened. And kind of the monologue is dealing with how that triggers various awarenesses of that, of the aging process.
I wonder, you know, you're getting very well known now, and like at the Sundance Film Festival, just reading the press coverage of it at home, you were quoted a lot, and it seemed like people really enjoyed hearing from you and everything. And I wonder whether it's like for you, whether that's making you feel more centered, more appreciated.
You know what's happened? There's a repeat. You see, Monster in a Box, the film and the monologue, was about the dizziness, I say, that comes from too much possibility after swimming to Cambodia. When I was just trying to do one thing and write my book, Impossible Vacation. I know this is all confusing because it's such a hall of mirrors, but the monologue is about trying to write the book and all the distractions that take me away from that because of the popularity of swimming to Cambodia. Now, if Monster in a Box is popular as a film, I'm going to get offers again, and I simply don't know how to make choices. I've already been offered to write a feature film for Columbia Pictures on the life of Thoreau. And they said, if we could get your name on this script, we might be able to get someone like De Niro or Robin Williams to play Thoreau. And I thought, oh, my God, what about me? I should be playing Thoreau. This is ridiculous. And I got an offer to go to the Philippines to study psychic surgeons, to look at them to see if their fakers are real and see if I could have an operation on myself so that could be a part of Gray's Anatomy. Then the other offer was to go to Hong Kong for PBS and do Spalding Gray's Hong Kong, which, I'm all considering them, but I wake up in the morning and sit there paralyzed at this point because I can't quite visualize. I've always worked serendipitously. The choices are just so arbitrary to me, and I usually report about sort of what comes along. And so it's going to happen again. It's going to happen again. And I can't repeat Monster in a Box, you know, so what am I going to do? I don't know what's next.
I'd say you need a vacation, but
exactly.
You're not the right person to say that to.
Yeah, right. I mean, when was the last one you took?
Me?
The last vacation.
I actually take vacations.
You do? Okay.
Yeah.
And you can accomplish unwinding on them.
Well, to a large extent, it kind of works because I have the kind of... See, like in your novel, you write about how the problem with taking a vacation is that you have to have a kind of routinized life to take a vacation
right.
from. And I've
exactly.
got that kind of life, you know.
Yes.
So when I take a vacation, I'm actually getting away from something.
Exactly. You see, I was in Taos, New Mexico before I came to Los Angeles, and I really wanted to stay there. But I also knew that that I had all of this mishigas. My head was going on there about as much as it is here. So I'm never quite, I don't have those boundaries, you see, because I'm one would say that I'm always working because I'm always observing and digesting and working from anecdote and telling stories, whether they're, you know, one-on-one or in public. So that is a problem there. That is a problem, working from yourself.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Spalding Gray, and he has a new novel, his first novel, called Impossible Vacation. He also has... There's a new movie of his latest monologue, Monster in a Box, which is about all the distractions he faced while writing his new novel. Monster in a Box is not only a film, there's also a new book version of it. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Spalding Gray is my guest. Your character longs to find something he could be passionate about to give his life meaning.
Mm-hmm.
I figure maybe you went through a phase like that yourself, but it seems to me that when you did find it, and that being theater and your monologues, that you probably became really obsessive about it.
Yes, that became, I think I was probably obsessed before that, but probably with finding that. my therapist, the one I recently gave up in New York City for all sorts of problems, said that I was only happy when I was unhappy. And that was pretty hard to take, but my retaliation was this: does that mean I'm happy then? And he said, no, it means you're obsessed. So by that I mean, he was probably saying, one protects themselves from happiness by obsession. And to be able to let that go would be a big, big thing in my life, a very big and important thing to do, and something I think might be a major project.
Where'd you let the therapist go?
I stopped with him because... he was doing what I think was bad countertransference. That he was entering into my drama, and I'm always creating drama when I'm not doing a monologue, because I'm really creating the next drama for the next monologue, either consciously or unconsciously. And I think that he allowed me to get too deeply into a fantasy that I actually could not integrate. And I began to distrust him enormously on that, and thought that I actually thought countertransference was going on, and he wouldn't admit to it. And in fact, he would not admit to being fallible, and that was disturbing.
So I don't understand what the fantasy was.
You don't understand what the fantasy was? Well, I have to tell you, Terry, that's a private thing.
Oh, fine.
I'm having
no, that's
a private
fine.
Life
no, no, no,
now.
No. Good for you.
Yeah.
Is that new? I mean, that you're
yeah.
drawing the line.
Yes, it is.
I'm not sure you've ever said to me.
I'm trying to make some adult lines now,
actually. Yeah, I'm not sure you've ever said to me in an interview before, that's a private thing.
That's a breakthrough, isn't it?
Well, yeah. God. Yeah. I think that's great.
Yeah. There it is. Yeah, I'm trying to work on some boundaries between the private and the public. And that's actually where the novel worked for me. I learned a lot of that in the novel. Because two things are happening there. First of all, the persona of Bruce the North. And second of all, the print is a form. It's like a girdle. It's like a outline. It has boundaries because it's set. And whereas the spoken word is so fluid that one is tempted, or I am tempted, just to say everything that's on my mind. Because it's not being processed as much as it is through print and the editorial process. And I think that when I'm speaking the words, I actually think that they're real. When I'm writing them, I can see that they're symbolic. Do you know what I mean? Do you know the difference there, what I'm saying?
I do, but I think also another thing is that the evidence lingers longer on the page. It's permanent, you know, in a way that you can fool yourself that it's not permanent when you're saying something.
Exactly, exactly. It has much more power for people, too. I mean... because it's there, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's there as a product. You have it as proof in front of you. I have it as proof in front of me. And with the spoken word, it's much more airy, you know, much more in the moment, and disappears immediately unless you're being taped.
Right. So listen, Spaulding, I went to see that Dolly Parton movie just to see you.
Ah, I haven't seen it.
Oh.
I just ran into James Woods in the bookstore here, and I talked to him about the film, but I hadn't seen it. What did you think?
Well, I'll be honest, I didn't like the movie very much.
Yeah,
it's one of these life force movies where, like, somebody with a lot of life force, in this case, Dolly Parton, teaches the world to enjoy life because she's just got so much positive energy and so much kind of down-home wisdom.
Right,
and it's a whole genre now.
It is.
But it seems to me this kind of life force movie is exactly like the opposite kind of movie that you would ever... feel most comfortable in.
I know. And again, it was one of those why not things. Why not be a psychiatrist in the film with Dolly Parton and give it a try and see if I can have a good time with it. And I did for the 2 or 3 days that we were shooting it. And then it was over, and that was that. And then the last thing I did was with Paul Mazursky in The Pickle. You know, I play all these doctors. It's silly. It's a must be my Christian Science karma coming back on me. But Paul Mazursky had a wonderful sense of humor. He decided to name me Dr. Edward Spaulding, and I had a card that read Dr. Edward Spaulding. So I rush in, and it's supposed to be in the plaza in New York City, but it's actually out here where they build a room like the plaza. And I rush in, and I say, "Hello, I'm Dr. Spaulding. Where is the patient?" So it's a wonderful in thing. You know, it's almost, it's really rather campy to have it, because there the fans that know me can laugh at being Dr. Spaulding. So it's just a kind of funny thing to do. But Paul Mazursky came raving back afterwards and said, "You know, I actually know you're a very good actor. I had forgotten, because I equate you with a monologue form. But you know, the thing that you should do, if you're going to do a feature film, you really should play the John Cheever story." And I said, "Oh, absolutely, Paul. You direct it, and we raise the money on Spaulding Gray's name and the theme of bisexual alcoholic writer lives in despair on the Hudson River. I think America will just love it." So that's where I never fit in. I mean, I fit in little cameos, but I think if you took my whole sensibility and intellect and irony and tried to figure out how that could fit into this an American story, which really no one wants to hear right now because they'd rather see a positive, a clearly positive force, a green tomato, what have you, it's a tricky business because it's too complicated, actually. I think I'm too complicated to something that was a fully developed character.
Now that you're kind of drawing more of a line between what's part of the public autobiography and what's to be kept personal, this is stuff you might not want to talk about, but I know you got married last August to Renee Shafransky, who's been your longtime companion and also your longtime collaborator. Do you mind talking about why you decided to do something formal and get married?
Yes, well, that's part of the new monologue, Grey's Anatomy. And what it had to do with was this. When I was having my eye operation, Renee found it very difficult to have access to me because she was known as the girlfriend. And she says, "You're getting older. You probably will be in the hospital in the future. I think I should be the wife so that they'll let me in to see you. It just is easier that way." And we actually went into therapy and talked about it. And I proposed to her in therapy. I proposed by saying, "Do you still really want to get married?" And I asked her, and she giggled and was... And I saw that she really did, and that was important for her. And I thought that I could do it, even though I didn't understand why I didn't want to do it. And now I probably am understanding that more, because what we were before was a safer thing for me. It was like what you refer to as agricultural time. It's more circular, in which we'd reconnect through various anniversaries and seasons. And the marriage felt to me like a dart that was going straight, linear, toward a dartboard that could only be interrupted by two D's, death or divorce. And so there was a line there that was supposed to make you feel more secure, and I think it does, Renee, but in me, made me feel a little more claustrophobic. And so I think that's the difference in the experience that we've both had. And all at the same time, she doesn't like calling me her wife. She does not like that word, so I'm now referring to her as my ex-girlfriend.
What kind of, you know, a lot of people like write their own marriage vows.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and so some of them, I have to say with all due respect, are just like really corny and a little bit embarrassing. So how did you decide to go about that?
This was a very beautiful ceremony. I have to say, a week before it, I almost drowned. And that was quite an experience because there was no lifeguard. We were going to get married on the beach. I almost drowned off the... Look, I knew there was a lot of turbulence coming up around the marriage because when we went out to select the house to get married in, it was wintertime. And we were out there alone, and I had a dream that I was lying on a pile of ashes, and that my body was filtering into the ashes, and the ashes were coming up into my body, and there was no separation. And when I woke up, I thought, what were those ashes? They were shaped like a sleeping bag, like a mummy bag, like a mummy. Oh, God, oh, God, I thought, I'm not free of her yet. And that was the dream that first came around trying to select the house in which to get married. Then, as we get closer to the marriage, I almost drowned, and there was no lifeguard, and Renee started yelling for men on the beach, and the reason that they went out is because they recognized my head from the poster Swimming to Cambodia.
Oh, no!
Yes, because it looked like the poster. It was as though I was reliving the poster. And this guy, a chiropractor from Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, first reached me with a yellow boogie board, and I grabbed onto that, and they pulled me in, and they all wanted to photograph me on the beach, standing next to them, saying, if you ever do a monologue, please include my name. I'm the chiropractor from Punxsutawney. And so the closer I got to the marriage, the more I started to get into these panic things. And then just 5 days before the marriage, a major hurricane hit, if you remember this, and tore everything apart, all the marriage plans. And I said to Renee, I see this as a sign. And she said, I see it as a challenge. And this is the difference between the two of us. She rallied her forces. She outdid that hurricane. She brought that whole wedding together. And it was a very beautiful ceremony. And it was on the beach that it was. And it came, the sun came out, and we were drinking champagne, and our lawyer married us. And he wrote the ceremony based on all of the things that had happened leading up to the marriage, the hurricane, the almost drowning, not the ashes dream, and said that quote, you know, Renee saw it as a challenge, Spaulding saw it as a sign. But he really talked about being together for as long as the two of you shall love. And it was a very simple, beautiful ceremony that simply retraced our history together. And then we signed the papers right there on the beach with the wind blowing and everyone standing around, and it was a small ceremony. And I have to say, the marriage itself was beautiful. You know, the wedding was beautiful. But the wedding is one thing, marriage is another. And people must remember that they're two very different things. The marriage is ongoing. The wedding was for a day. I'd love to get married once a year. Again, you know, to Renee, it was a lovely party, and all the sun came out, and all things blessed us. All things blessed us.
Well, Spaulding, great to talk to you, and thanks so much for coming. Spaulding Gray's new novel is Impossible Vacation. His monologue, Monster in a Box, has been adapted into a new film. There's also a new paperback edition of the monologue. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.